One, two, three, four.
But that transformation was key to my next step as an artist, to knowing that's what acting is. It isn't just posing. It isn't just being a version of yourself. It wasn't performing. It was transforming. And I think that artists find that in many different ways. And as actors, there are many ways into that. But I would encourage you to, if you're an actor, know your own equipment, know your own psychology, and use the great teachers that are synthesized in my favorite teacher's book. Larry Moss is who I studied with later, and there's a book called Intent to Live that distills down Uta Hagen and Stella Adler and Bobby Lewis and Stanislavski, the great teachers at the group theater, the method that needed to be altered to be constructive rather than destructive to artists. David Melch's mind is so singular because he uses language in a way that defines character. That's what all good writers do, is use language to get to the heart of something. And he would use malaprops for Sipowicz, and Milch loved playing with that. And as someone who played the love interest of such a unique character as Sipowicz, so it's through Sylvia, and that's David Milch's understanding, that his wife humanized Sipowicz as an addict, as a very flawed human who had many addictions. And that's David Milch's. He's now suffering Alzheimer's, so we won't get his words again. But the words that he has to offer are timeless because he studied Robert Penwar, and he had so many mentors through his vast literary education. And that's key. I love speaking Noel Coward words. As a bon vivant, as someone who wrote musically, who wrote to charm us, to amuse us. So going and reading Noel Coward is, it's important for actors to learn those cadences, to learn the musicality of a certain era. Of course, Shakespeare. I think of the female playwrights who delight me now, whether it's Carol Churchill, you know, that singular mind and playing with gender that she was so good at, and challenging gender norms. Seeing Cloud Nine when I was in college blew my mind open because men were playing women and women were playing men. And of course, Shakespeare was doing it too, but hers, I don't know, it was an intimate, it was a small theater. And that's another thing I encourage actors and audiences to do. Go see things in small theaters. See it close up, because that will excite you to learn the craft.
Sharon Lawrence is an acclaimed actress best known for her Emmy-nominated SAG Award-winning role as ADA Sylvia Costas on NYPD Blue. She has delivered memorable performances in Desperate Housewives, Monk, Law & Order SVU, Criminal Minds, Shameless, and Queen Sugar. On stage, she's earned praise for roles in The Shot, a one-woman play about the owner and publisher of The Washington Post, Katharine Graham, Orson's Shadow, and A Song at Twilight. She starred in Broadway revivals of Cabaret, Chicago, and Fiddler on the Roof. Her recent work includes the neo-Western series Joe Pickett, opposite Michael Dorman, and the films Solace with Anthony Hopkins and The Bridge Partner. Lawrence is also a dedicated advocate, serving on the boards of the SAG-AFTRA Foundation, We for She, and Heal the Bay, and is a former chair of the Women in Film Foundation. Sharon Lawrence, welcome to The Creative Process.
Thank you. So happy to be here.
Yes, so you've just undertaken what I think is quite a unique, challenging role in White Rabbit, Red Rabbit. Mm. As from my understanding, it's you're performing the script cold.
Yes.
Wow. And I mean, given your background where you've, you know, extensive rehearsals before in theater and then in television, you work on Broadway, you've done, you know, Chicago, you were Emmy nominated for your role of Sylvia Costas in NYPD Blue. All these things are very well scripted. But how did that absence for a White Rabbit, Red Rabbit, absence of rehearsal director, I mean, just how does that work? Is that kind of thrilling, but, you know, frightening?
It is thrilling. It is frightening. And the exhilaration that I, as an actor, get, first time I am married to a text, is often, in my estimation, the purest version that will ever exist for me. It takes a long time to let words play you. Actors often talk about Well, I mean, the word is play. You're doing a play or you're playing a character, whether it's on screen or on stage. But the goal in that flow state that anybody who creates understands is where it's playing you, where you are out of the way. And there are two times that that happens, I have found, in my 40 plus years of doing this as a professional, but, you know, 63 years of doing it just as a being who has an imagination and was always expressing myself through words. That is the first time you read something out loud, the first time you are putting your voice to it. And oftentimes you say yes to an opportunity to do a reading, knowing that you won't get the script until you are lending your voice to it. It's rare to have it happen like this because you do never see. You're not supposed to have ever seen the show or ever have really any information or discussion with other actors about it. And it's a big hit. It's been playing around the world for close to 10 years now. Because it is successful, it is a formula for success. And that has to do with the material that Nassim Soleimpour, who is an Iranian writer and dissident who's had to leave his country and for many years was not allowed to leave his country. He couldn't have a passport. So he is in a compelling position as a storyteller. And those of us who have freedom, creative and political freedom, I think we're drawn to serve an artist who doesn't have that. But there's a playfulness apart from the political aspect of this. And the term white rabbit, red rabbit alone draws you in. And I'm certainly in a lineage of many respected actors who have done this. So I had a faith that it would be worth my time and is structured in a way that supports the artist. But what it does require is a freedom. And that freedom, as I was talking about earlier, when a text plays you, is what actors are always searching for. And it can take years to accomplish that, where you are carried by the material. You aren't ahead of yourself. You're not behind yourself. You're right in the moment. And that's what happens with me. It happened with me with White Rabbit, Red Rabbit. And it happened with the audience, too, because the audience is a partner and you see them and they are involved. There is audience participation. There are people in the audience who have seen it, so they've seen others play and they know what's coming, but there are many who don't. And it's another reason that I love to be an audience member is I am in the moment in a theatrical endeavor. I am in the moment exclusively because, unlike many other forms of entertainment now, you should not be on your device at all. You must be paying attention to what's going on in front of you on the stage. Your focus cannot be bifurcated. It's a sacred space like a religious service should be, and artists and the culture should be holding you accountable to that. Meaning, if you are on your phone, you have broken a sacred bond and somebody will stop you. And those kinds of activities and engagement are rare.
And it's so true. And so have you, from your theater work, have you done a lot of improvisation? Do things like that, can they help prepare you for something that is this unexpected?
Well, this play, White Rabbit, Red Rabbit, is everything is written for you. And there's guided instructions. That's all I'm going to say, because I don't want any actress who may be listening to this to have their opportunity polluted by my saying too much. But the actor makes choices as to how to interpret what's on the page. And that is embedded in their movement, in their attitude, and in their willingness to go with the picture that is painted, and the shift of gears, and the job any actor has, or any spoken word has, to auditorily draw the audience into a world that suspends disbelief and transports them to feel, to visualize, to engage.
I do want to ask, we talked before about NYPD Blue, and I just love writer David Milch. Just tell us a little bit about some of those other writers, collaborators that, you know, it's a pleasure to read their words, or they're just like, you learn so much.
David Melch's mind is so singular, and there are some lectures. I believe it's either UCLA or USC, and you can find them on YouTube. And I encourage people who are writers and or actors to watch that, because he uses language in a way that defines character. That's what all good writers do, is use language to get to the heart of something. And he would use malaprop for Sipowicz. Sipowicz would make up words. And so Milch loved playing with that. And as someone who played the love interest of such a unique character as Sipowicz, she's absorbing it and allowing the audiences to fall in love with Sipowicz. So they didn't create Sylvia before the show was set to air. They found that a love interest and our chemistry, Dennis and I's chemistry, and our introduction as characters, as adversaries in that courtroom, made us a compelling and a discovery for David Milch and Stephen Bochco. And they knew that softening Sipowicz was important for us to fall in love with him and to be able to explore issues like racism, like a white cop's instinct to protect his tribal feelings. And it was only through humanizing him through someone who was educated and elevated and challenged his ability to become the better version of himself by making him a father of a newborn when he's a grown man rather than a young man. You know, his first child, young parents, I don't want to say suffer, but they didn't have the wisdom of an older parent, or the commitment of an older parent to tackle the alcoholism that Sipowicz had. So it's through Sylvia, and that's David Milch's understanding, that his wife humanized Sipowicz as an addict, as a very flawed human who had many addictions. And that's David Milch's. He's now suffering Alzheimer's, so we won't get his words again, but the words that he has to offer are timeless because he studied Robert Penwar, and he had so many mentors through his vast literary education. And that's key. I love speaking Noel Coward words as a bon vivant, as someone who wrote musically, who wrote to charm us, to amuse us. So going and reading Noel Coward is, it's important for actors to learn those cadences, to learn the musicality of a certain era, of course, Shakespeare. I think of the female playwrights who delight me now, whether it's Carol Churchill, you know, that singular mind and playing with gender that she was so good at and challenging gender norms. Cloud Nine, seeing Cloud Nine when I was in college blew my mind open, because men were playing women and women were playing men. I think that's why I was able to, that next year, become somebody else as Electra, because I saw it modeled, the boldness. And of course, Shakespeare was doing it too, but hers, I don't know, it was an intimate, it was a small theater. And that's another thing I encourage actors and audiences to do. Go see things in small theaters. See it close up, because that will excite you to learn the craft, to learn about the craft, to support it.
Yeah, it's a small theater. You could feel almost the actor's breath upon your face. Oh. I was lucky to attend an actor's workshop here in Paris with John Patrick Shanley, and that was a very intimate experience. You know, they're trying it out for the first time, you know, just with, you know, and they haven't memorized it. So that was fun.
And improv. Yeah, you mentioned improv. That's important too. Viola Spolin wrote the definitive book on theater games, and Alan Alda was a mentor for me. By the way, he's got a great podcast, Clear and Vivid, where he has committed to teaching scientists how to communicate their work better to lay people. And it was through the use of improv that he does that. So if you are a scientist that wants to be able to get that grant to make your work accessible to others, you can follow along in Alan Alda's podcast, but also recognize that theater games and improv is a great way to learn how to do that for yourself. It's a challenge, but it is a freedom that you probably won't find in other ways. And it's structured. There's a process. It isn't a free-for-all. It's very well designed to have you open up in a way that will delight you and encourage you to communicate better.
Yes, and I will second. Actually, Alan Alda was supposed to come on our show, but then he was wrapping the final film of Ray Donovan, so it didn't happen. Clear and Vivid is excellent, and I will ring him up and see if we can ever do that conversation. Yes, and David Milch's, some of those lectures are really beautiful. I'm always quoting who he quoted, Kierkegaard. The self rests transparently on the spirit that gives it rise. And these are some of the things embedded in his writing that you, if you can, you just find it's there. You know, as you say, all these great writers, they're building upon the writers from history. And that
they are products of their time. And he will say so. They are products of their time. It was a boys' club. But that does not negate the power of the poetry and of the aspiration for transformation. And we as women and we as underserved communities, as communities that were not privileged, when you read Maya Angelou, when you read Ta-Nehisi Coates, when you read Lynn Nottage, she wrote Intimate Apparel, beautiful words. We must read all the cultures. We must read. It's my homework too, my homework now. I'm at the point of my life where championing those coming up and others is the joy. It is the joy. There's a beautiful new play called Tasty Little Rabbit. Is that a theme? Perhaps. But it is about the photographers or the artists who were using the new technology, the nascent technology of photography in the 1890s in Sicily, a region called Taormina, where it was for homosexuals who were fleeing the oppression of their cultures. And photography had just begun, and artists that were using that new technology were posing beautiful young men as gods, as nymphs, as fairies. And many of us have seen those sepia tone photographs, and you'll know what I'm speaking of. And they are beautiful, and they honor the human form. They honor youth and beauty. They honor the myths and the passion and the pain, the love, the dreamlike quality, the ideals of the human form and the human heart and aspiration. It also takes place in the 1930s when the fascists in Italy were to prosecute those artists for what would be considered obscenities. And that fascism that was taking hold in the 30s, pre-World War II, by the way, Mussolini's purist theology and doctrines and ideology, which we are recognizing is happening all around the world now, an echo of that, is examined by talking to the artists themselves. The artists who have aged now 40 years, photographers gone, but the models were there, and their explanation of that. And a figure in this play written by Tom Jacobson shows up under a pseudonym. And that person who is enthusiastic about the art and very curious in an analytical and romantic and admiration and yet challenge to the new technology is actually Oscar Wilde, who was imprisoned in England for what was considered gross indecency, his homosexuality. Even in the midst of his huge success with his two greatest plays, right? The Importance of Being Earnest. But he had fled to Italy. And there's a debate in the play about whether or not words paint a picture better, or does an image paint a picture for the viewer? Is art better if it's imagined through the recipient and having to create their own image in their head? Or is a pure form capturing an image, a photograph, even more pure than an impressionist vision of art? These debates continue to go on. And of course, now with AI, we are asking computers to render images that could never exist. And we will be grappling with what is true, what is art, what is journalism, what is being represented as truth, as fact, when it is indeed created out of an intention, whether it's benign or nefarious.
Yeah, we actually have a channel AI in the Future of Humanity, which we launched before the rollout of general AI. And so, yes, AI, that is a big question. That it's changing journalism, the disinformation, the way it can be abused.
The deep fakes.
Yeah, abused by bad actors, by political parties on all sides. And and so that's disturbing. It's changing also our perception of what is beautiful and what is real. And that, I mean, that's something I would like to go into even more a bit later in the conversation. But I was very interested in that question you said about forms of storytelling, like a pure storytelling that might be pared down through an image, that I think that can be really deep. I'm a painter, so you would say that it can be really deep if the audience that receives it are literate in reading images or give it the time to read the images. If it's just an image that isn't received with reverence and time, then maybe it's not. When I think about you've performed musical theater and television and plays, you're talking about Oscar Wilde and photographers at the birth of photography. So I think that each story finds the form it needs, right? But I love that phrase that you said, that when you're so deep within a script or you're encountering the story, the character for the first time, you have that, it's almost first love, and then it starts to play on you. That's very mysterious to me.
Well, I hope illustrate it in talking about a project that I've been doing for a while now. I've been playing Katharine Graham, who was the publisher of the Washington Post during Watergate and the Pentagon Papers era first. She was the daughter of the owner of the paper. He bought it in 1938. It was the fifth worst rated newspaper in Washington, D.C. when he, who was a financier and a very influential figure in government, as a matter of fact, he became the head of the World Bank. He had bought the paper. He was an immigrant from Austria and had married an American. She was one of the middle children of five. And she was an introvert, but very much an intellectual. And she did have a college education in the 30s when many women did not. Her father bought the paper in 1933. And she never imagined that she would have to take over the paper because women did not have the potential for that kind of leadership at that point. But when he was ready to move on in the next phase of his career, he did give the paper's publishing position to Kay's brilliant husband, who was an attorney and a clerk at the Supreme Court for Felix Frankfurter, very bright and also very troubled. He had bipolar disorder. And back in those times, there was very little treatment for such a difficult disease. That did not dim his brilliance until later. And sadly, in 1963, he took his own life. And she wanted to keep the newspaper in the family. Her father had long deceased, and there was no other sibling in her generation that had wanted it. And it was her passion, even as the wife of the publisher. She was very involved because she was a Washington hostess and had influence. She decided that she would become the publisher herself until her children were old enough to take over the paper. But she had to learn. As an introvert, this was a very challenging risk for her to take because her leadership had to be built while she was in the position of leadership. So our story is about that, and it's also about the domestic violence that she experienced in the midst of that marriage to a mentally ill husband. And I've been doing this play now for 5 years. And what that has meant is that I'm the only one that's read this role, that's said these words out loud. The playwright and the director, all three of us have worked on it 5 years, and we have developed it with the dramaturgy that it requires, meaning we've taken scenes out, we've recognized the structure of the play has had to be challenged. We have played in different regions of the country. We've had small theaters, like 50-seat houses. So I am within 10 feet or less of the front row, you know, 350-seat houses. The experience theatrically has changed and shifted. We've worked on what the wig should look like for her, what the costumes look like, what the reveal of the domestic violence on her body looks like. So we continued to experiment. And in doing it this long, there are moments and there are sometimes entire, you know, it's happened a couple of times where I liken it to a slalom, a downhill ski run, that you know the terrain so well you can forget about it. The gravity takes you and your body knows how to lean in, and you have maximized, if you're a skier, you know, or an auto racer, which I've done also, you maximize the turns. You are as efficient as possible in wasting no moment. You're not ahead of yourself. You're not behind yourself. And that flow state I've been able to achieve in this. And it's because I know it so well. And people who've played roles over and over again in Shakespeare, you get, or any good classic text, you've gotten there and it's playing you. And it's repetition, that only really repetition, that can allow you that flow state, I think, or the first time.
And I'm wondering, I mean, also the key or the trick to yourself is to make it new at the same time as you know what's coming, but you have to believe it's for the first time. And so I'm wondering, a part of that might be interesting both for audiences and for yourself as Catherine, playing it, say, you know, when we've just had Me Too, I guess the role was just forming at the height of Me Too and all of this awareness, and you're portraying intimate depiction of domestic violence. And then at the same time, you're playing, you know, the head of a newspaper at a time when newspapers had that power. And while you've been performing it, I can't imagine, I don't know how many local newspapers we've seen the demise of, you know, as we speak. I mean, there are so many jobs, so many journalists losing their jobs. So we've seen the decline in that. Washington Post is just now hanging on by a thread, but, you know, because it's being supported, and New York Times, and, you know, there's not a lot that have a good business model. So this all makes it relevant. And then we've just had Signalgate, as I think about Watergate, Signalgate, which was a different thing, but still very serious, to have war plans leaked to the Atlantic, but by incompetence, not like a sinister, but just, so it has this kind of resonance that I think for audiences going to is like, you know, this is still fresh. This is not historic. It is historic, but we have our own iterations.
Well, yes, technology has been what's changed so much. We are at risk of the unintended consequences and lack of sophistication or wisdom. And our wisdom has not caught up with our technology. The Signalgate, I think, is a prime example of hubris as much as carelessness. You know, I don't think it is a coincidence. It may be ironic, but I don't think it's a coincidence that it was a journalist who misused the technology because of their inherent drive to the fatal flaw in the culprit's choice, that they just can't resist telling the story to people who do not need to be in the room. And that carelessness is due to an impulse to broadcast, appropriate or not, right? And I'm using that term loosely, but there's a training, a personality, a drive to, and that is why a free press is so, I believe, will always be a goal of a free and progressive society, and why it is always a goal of an oppressive society to control it, because we know the power of it. In Kay Graham's time, for those people who listening who may not know, Nixon resigned, our president resigned, because the press, in particular the Washington Post, successfully uncovered wiretappings. And that alone, it's interesting to see now that taping conversations and revealing conversations and confidentiality is all now, I think, very much at risk because our technology makes it so easy to do so. But he and his party, the Republican Party, believed that it was indeed a breach of democracy. And democracy dying in darkness being a motto of a national newspaper is very true. But she used her power and her influence at great risk, because the president was still controlling, and the FCC was controlling their licensing, their ability to publish and to broadcast, because they owned radio and television stations. And we see now the levers of government being pulled indeed in an extraordinary way, because those few people and few entities and corporations that control the chain of global media are concerned about access and the government, this administration's choices to control what will be broadcast. And that has to do with not just licenses, but the hardware. And by hardware, I mean satellites. You know, this is something that only big dominant power can control, and the value system and beliefs that people in power hold put us all in either a vacuum or an open system or a closed system. So it's challenging.
And so I can really hear that. I know that your father was a television journalist, and you also studied journalism. That was your degree. And I just want to read something that you said, speaking of your role in the shot. What one would hope is that in this era, in Kay's era, the common person had a bit more media literacy. Their attention spans were greater. They had a choice to read and compare and to understand who the owner of the paper was really speaking for and about. Now we think we know, but what are the shadows at play? And I think that says it. Exactly. I mean, it's about cultivating our critical thinking. I don't know, this attention media landscape, it makes it so hard. We're bombarded. I believe the amount of data that's being stored is doubling every 2 years. But are we learning the lessons? You know, we're drowning in data, but starved of knowledge, as you say, the wisdom. And how we can implement that within our own lives and within our own communities is something, it takes that extra effort and intention.
It does. And it is also driven by commerce. It's interesting that Harvard has made the choice to offer free courses on government because civics isn't taught in our public school system any longer. It was taught when I was coming up, but it's not taught now. And I think that there's a strategy behind that to dismantle the understanding of what the system is, because then you can ride roughshod over the system or shape it. And I read this in one of my favorite magazines, The Sun magazine. Are you familiar with The Sun magazine?
Yes, I know The Sun magazine.
Yeah. It was an article about democracy. And the study of democracy has shown that most democracies throughout history have only survived 4 years. The American system of democracy has survived so much longer. But it does not guarantee it, of course. Nothing guarantees it, except the willingness to protect it, the willingness by the people who are living under it and in power of it too. And that will mean that it must change and evolve around the technology and the realities of our world. So, of course, that brings to mind, does the Electoral College support democracy any longer? We're no longer the same kind of system that needed more representation because the population of certain states were smaller than others, the concentration of population. All those things need to be debated. But the only way we can do that is if we participate as citizens because we choose to educate ourselves. Look, you know, this sounds like a lecture. That's not what we want to do
no,
here now.
But no, that's okay. And it's very interesting. And I think it's apt to your role. But I'll put a little shout out there for deliberative democracy. I just had a conversation with James Fishkin, who heads the Deliberate Democracy Lab at Stanford. And it is possible to small groups of people, technology in that case, AI, can use them as moderators, groups of 6-12 people, and actually debate, getting packets of information, not partisan, and just debating it and really voting, not just on the candidate, but actually on the issues. So that's really promising. And they've done it in countries around the world, including America. So it's possible.
That's great. I'd like to know more about that. I will listen to that interview with great interest and share it, because we can't pretend that the technology isn't there. It's just a matter of how to use it to our benefit. Cultures who are underrepresented in the development and the access to technology is really key. You know, if net neutrality goes away in this country, I mean, it already has. By that meaning, who has access to the internet? And that has to do with whether or not the government will invest in fiber optics that will send the signal everywhere, our rural communities. Is Puerto Rico at risk because it's not wired the same way? What value system do we place on that? And who funds it? And who gets to vote in the bills that our government spends on? This is a high priority. And not just for commerce, but for media.
It's so complicated.
Well, let's talk a little bit about fictional worlds. The real world can get very heavy. But yeah, but this is actually interesting because you have often played really powerful, vulnerable, yet powerful people. I mean, you played Vivian Lee, the actress. Okay, again, on something that was dealing about mental health and you know, all the kind of issues that they wave their way through. But you played very powerful. You know, when I just see you on screen, I feel like, oh, you're so capable or steely. I mean, it's just kind of, it's a shorthand thing that I see in your different roles. Or like, if Cabaret, Chicago, you know, on stage, or Queen's Sugar. You know, it's just this kind of thing. I mean, I don't know. And yet they're all different, these roles, but that's a kind of area that I think that you hone. So whether, I know you said you didn't want to talk about politics, but I don't think it's accidental that these roles find you, because you communicate that. And obviously it's in your DNA, just from your father, news journalism. And just, it seems like your, you know, your awareness of political events or, you know, power play is something that is, you've imbibed from a young age.
That's true. I was born this way. And by this way, I mean an extrovert. And I had a safe and uncomplicated childhood. And that is luck. You know, you can argue if you believe in a more metaphysical sense that we choose these scenarios that we are born into. If I made a choice, I made a good choice in ways to be a storyteller who can, without harm, play characters who are challenged, like Katharine Graham. I've never experienced the trauma that she's experienced, and so I'm safe when I play her. But I think that there is something to be said for coming up in the era that I did, which meant that I was watching women evolve in our culture. As a young woman, I saw and benefited from the freedom of women who were just coming into the workplace, who were living as single women in television shows like the Mary Tyler Moore Show. That was so influential. Ask any woman my age, and you will recognize the subversiveness of a character who not only had a career and was unmarried, but could speak in certain episodes about birth control. I came about in an era where the birth control pill was being normalized as my sexual maturity was coming about. I had choices. I had bodily autonomy. And the images of women that I saw were appealing to me. They were able to make a choice to pursue their creative power, and it was celebrated. And that is why I believe the vibration of the characters that I play have that quality, because I witnessed it and it was normalized and celebrated in society for me. I played queens who were given respect early on in my career, and I was playing sexual beings who gained power from their inherent power. They were given power and they were powerful because of their inherent sexual quality. So when you marry those two things together, like I was able to do as a reader, absorbing stories and material and writers and styles, you start to build a matrix of what qualities you can bring. Add on to that, one of the first transformative acting roles that I ever played was Electra in an adaptation of The Greeks. It was in college at UNC Chapel Hill, and I really did transform for the first time. By that, I mean, I was playing a character that had such great pain. Electra is she has a daddy complex. She is betrayed by her stepmother. She has an odd relationship with her brother. And she is exiled. She is set to inherit power, but she's exiled and goes mad. But there are women around her who gather and see that wound. And she's very much a human. She's not a goddess. She's a human who is stripped of her power, but she mourns that. And in our version, she's doing self-harm. So I'm playing things that I'd never played with before. We created a version of her that was very androgynous. I chopped my hair off to play her. I wore a burlap sack, so all sexuality was gone. That was something that was very interesting to me as a 20-year-old to not use that. I carried an Uzi. I wore a black leather motorcycle vest with one arm removed and a football shoulder pad out the side. So she took on the power of the male and yet the vulnerability of the female, because I used a knife as, like, you'll find, you know, this is trigger warning, but using a knife to dull the pain by not cutting, but grinding into her palm. I'd never witnessed these things. They were suggested by the directors, and I became somebody else. And it didn't mess me up because I was old enough, mature enough to understand what I was doing. But that transformation was key to my next step as an artist, to knowing that's what acting is. It isn't just posing. It isn't just being a version of yourself. It wasn't performing. It was transforming. And I think that artists find that in many different ways. And as actors, there are many ways into that. But I would encourage you to, if you're an actor, know your own equipment, know your own psychology, and use the great teachers that are synthesized in my favorite teacher's book. Larry Moss is who I studied with later, and there's a book called Intent to Live that distills down Uta Hagen and Stella Adler and Bobby Lewis and Stanislavski, the great teachers at the group theater, the method that needed to be altered to be constructive rather than destructive to artists. It's a sacred thing that we do, and I don't want to make it more precious than it is, but it is a sacrifice in a way. So you must understand how to use the power of that to be constructive rather than destructive. And good programs and good teachers know how to do that, and good performances will offer that up, and know that it takes time to feed yourself to be able to do it. I'm relying on the artists that are coming up, and we've got NEA grants that are being cut and grants here in California that are being cut. We must invest in artists, and that's going to take private money. We can't rely on the government to do it. It's going to take private money, and that's why I'm the board member of a theater company, raising money and supporting them with my own money. Because I know we must grow artists. They don't just happen.
Hello, my name is Alyssa Emond, and I am a rising junior at the University of Virginia, concentrating in global studies, French, and art. And I'm honored to be able to take a moment to reflect on this interview with Sharon Lawrence, a powerful actor who has dedicated her career and gifts to storytelling on screen and on stage, as well as advocacy for climate health and democracy. Sharon has a cultivated understanding of the medium she works with, something that is a testament to her dedication and passion throughout her life, as well as makes her a profoundly captivating and relatable speaker. While listening to Sharon discuss her experiences here with Maya, as well as other interviews from her plethora of previous roles, I found myself reflecting on my personal experience with theater as of late. I've recently taken a few courses at my university that dive into the structure of film and theater as art forms and political bodies, which spent multiple classes discussing some of the topics Sharon mentions. I recall being specifically captivated by the culture of theater, that relationship, that aura that can only come from months or years of work from writers, directors, actors, molding and breathing life into a story, to capture it and present it in one brief moment for one crowd, where no two showings of the same play will ever be alike. It's just so special and speaks to the continued existence of the art form. And this aura that Sharon touches on, I believe, is so important in discussions of modern news and technology, our desire to have as much information as possible, as fast as possible, in the palms of our hands. In contrast, plays combat this by slowly and thoughtfully forming the messages of their stories, making a story set in the 1960s like the one in The Shot, or an ancient Greek epic still resonate in audiences today. My favorite thing about Sharon is how easily she demonstrates the power of a voice, in art, in advocacy, in inspiring others. And I can't wait for her to continue sharing this voice with you all here today. Thank you, and now back to the episode.
Exactly. I mean, you've spoken about how you benefited from public education system in North Carolina, and you had access to these things when arts education, I guess, was more supported or more seen as viable. And I really find that so inspiring, talking about some of that inner work that you're doing, that you had from your teachers or drawing inspiration from your role in Elektra. Maybe you even could bring some of these longstanding mythologies into other roles, but we don't see it. Like it's kind of humming beneath the surface as you embody a character. But can you just step us through some of, it must change for your different roles, of course, but how you, some of that internal work that you undertake to create a believable reality in the moment, you know, the research, not just like an intellectual construct, but how you weave together something until it becomes a part of you.
Yes. My background in dance, which I didn't start young, and I wasn't a dance performer. I always performed. That was how I was built. So I didn't have to overcome a lot of societal obstacles for me to express myself in the way that was natural and kind of God-given. I mean, I talk about it as software and hardware. My father was a journalist, but he was also an amateur actor and really good. And he had encouragement back in high school when he was there in the 50s that encouraged that in a public high school system. So it was a value for my family. And I don't discount that. As a matter of fact, I count it as one of the great blessings. If I had, you know, been the way my husband is, which is as an athlete, and given that, you know, that freedom to pursue, then I wouldn't, you know, I might have chosen a different field, but this was what worked, what I was gifted with. And I say that because it came through my hardware, the way it was wired, and the software in the culture that was built around it. But it was up to me to develop it as a tool. So ballet was a really important foundational aspect because what it taught me was connectedness to my body. I know the difference between a movement that's inherent to Sharon, and that is instructive and descriptive and evocative of another type of carriage. I walk differently as Catherine Graham than I walk as myself. I know how to find her walk based on a couple of things. First of all, she was tall and she was insecure about that. So I'm not tall, but I know how to seem tall because there's a carriage that women who are uncomfortable with their height sort of universally talk about, and you can see it. They bring their shoulders down, and oftentimes they look underneath their eyes. They're bowing their heads in deference, for one thing, based on a culture and an era in which then they were raised. They're looking down at people based on their height, but they also don't want to tower over. So it's a combination of those things. I have often said that if I can get the hair right and the shoes right, I understand the carriage of the character. So for certain characters, you want to be in heels. It gives you a feminine quality, whether it's one that is sexually powerful or vulnerable, right? That you're teetering on a platform that gives you less stability. In Catherine's case, I wear flats because she does. She did often. And those allow me a flexibility of movement. I don't just play her. I play her husband. So, and I play her mother. So I position myself to play men. As people have said, why would you rather be called an actor than an actress? And it took me a while to really understand this. And it was another actor that I heard say it. It's because if I am called an actor, I can play anything. If I'm called an actress, I can only play women. So the term actor, I do embrace because I play men and I play a man in this play. And that maleness is a stance and it is a groundedness. It has to do with where you feel comfortable. Actors often have to lose their inhibitions around their pelvic area. And that's because it's so highly sexualized. Many actors have come through a childhood that has either suppressed that natural power center or abused it. So understanding whether your ability to be free with that first chakra, you can talk about the chakras in a way with the energy centers of characters. We talk about animal work. Does a character lead with their solar plexus because they feel strong enough and challenging enough to say, I can take a hit? You'll watch men walk that way. They want to prove they can take a hit. Of course, the shoulders tell a story Are the shoulders free and dropped, allowing for someone to have the sense that everything around them, the 360 degrees around them, they have mastery of? Or are the shoulders hunched because they're protecting themselves? And what's ironic is they never feel like they can see behind them. They're always nervous about what's coming up behind them. And part of that is because they can't, they don't have a 360 degree energetic input. I mean, it's just body mechanics. They're stuck. Their shoulders prevent them from feeling the energy that comes around them. Is a character driven forward by a freedom of movement or constricted by a tentative nature that means that they move with more care or more confidence? We learn through animal work so much. And by animal work, I mean taking an animal and studying it, really going to witness an animal in person for long periods of time and recreating that in front of people. If you've done the exercise and you've been guided through it in a way, and you can also do that with children too, because children oftentimes tend to be free. But it's important that we observe animals in nature as actors into a very primal aspect of a character if we have allowed ourselves to transform in front of other people. That means safe places to do that, safe places to look odd and foolish, or the fear of being foolish. One of my important lessons on playing Katharine Graham was vocal work. We must protect our voice. That is our instrument. And I adapt to her sound. There's enough video out there of her in her older years, and I'm playing her at so many ages, that there's a quality of pronunciation that has to do with the era that she grew up in. It was called standard received pronunciation or standard American speech, which it almost sounds British when people sound upper class. And there's a lot of reasons for that. It has to do with the American actors being trained by British elocution coaches. The old movies sound a certain way, so the women who are watching those movies sound like Katharine Hepburn because she was coached. She didn't grow up talking that way. She was trained to talk that way. Media influenced so much of that. And that's the way those women of that time period and men spoke. So I include that in the way Kay speaks, but I also have to include Alexander technique, which is the study of our human body and how sound is produced through breath and the freedom of breath and the instrument that is your jaw. Tension in the jaw is a big obstacle for actors and singers. We must learn through the great teachers, Kristen Linklater, Patsy Rodenberg, how we can free the voice. And that's important for anyone who's speaking publicly, is knowing how to free your voice. And if you're speaking publicly, it's such a fear for so many folks. I think it was Maslow's hierarchy of human nature and human fears. And the first is fear of death for humans. And the second is public speaking. So it's not a surprise that the voice becomes our kryptonite as actors if we don't protect it and learn to free it, because we know so much about someone. And if I think about what we don't want to do, how it changes the ability to express and hold. And that tearfulness oftentimes is felt in the throat. Remember, when you don't want to cry, you feel it in your throat, right? It's this part of our body as an actor is the gift. And so I encourage all actors to learn what it means to use your voice, because it will age with you and you have to protect it so it ages healthily.
I think those are so many important insights. I do want to go into your animal activism. I believe you're an advocate for the oceans. But just to go into that, because there is a real animal intelligence, as you know, and this animal communication that an animal would never say, like, I think, therefore I am, because they think with their whole body. They speak with their whole body. And I know that as an actor, you're attuned to it. We forget it, that our whole body is communicating. But an animal if they meet a human or another animal, whatever, they get it like that. Oh, danger. I read you. And they, because they're not just focusing on this little, this, the head and nothing else. So they're not listening to the word, they're reading you. So they really have situational awareness. And I think that's so smart, whether you're an actor, whether you're a politician, whether you're a scientist or anyone, you know, study animals. They will teach us so much. And the other thing I want to say, most animals, unless they've been badly damaged over time, they have such poise and they reserve their energy until they need it. So they don't put, they're like, it's life or death, and they summon it. And then they just lay back in the savannah or whatever, and they wait and they take it all in. But you don't even know what's going on in their mind. Yeah, I'm just saying, as humans, we tend to overthink everything, and that just creates all kinds of blockages. It can paralyze you with procrastination, whereas non-human animals, they just gauge things and they go for the kill. It's like what Nietzsche says, knowledge kills action. And I believe so does fear, and fearing our fears too. But tell us a little bit also, because you're an advocate for the oceans, and this is something for a long time for marine life and perhaps others, because I know you've also done breast cancer awareness. You have a few different special interests.
Yes. I got involved with ocean conservation because I had the privilege of scuba diving. And if you have seen under the surface and you've seen a dead reef, you recognize it is not nature. Nature doesn't kill reefs. Reefs die because of imposed conditions, and that is ocean acidification, and that has to do with the rising temperatures. And we know that the rising temperatures, you know, it's escalated faster because of the human effect on the planet. That's the science. I believe the science. It's also practices of logging that has sent silt down into the ocean floor in a faster rate. It's basically drown reefs in silt, which is the runoff from logging and farming that isn't sustainable. So the sunlight can't get down to the reef. And believe me, the most colorful reefs that you'll see are only about 30 feet below the surface. So the sunlight is playing on that, and it's part of the biochemistry of a reef. So when you see a dead reef, it's a skeleton that happened way too fast, because reefs will build over time. A section may die, but it builds before it looks like a white bleached skeleton. So I couldn't ignore that, and I got involved with PADI, the Professional Association of Dive Instructors, and did some public service announcements for them, and I was hosting a special about dolphins. So I was in the water scuba diving with dolphins, which is rare, too. You don't get to do that many places, because dolphins, they're not familiar with scuba equipment, and it makes them nervous. But also on a vessel called the Stanella, where we were free diving with dolphins, we were on snorkel, and we could swim with the Atlantic spotted dolphin pod that had been being studied by Dr. Denise Herzing for the past probably 30 years now. And those dolphins are very curious about us. When their interaction with humans is interesting, they have a quality almost like dogs that makes them want to get up closer and use their bodies to absorb us. Whether a dog will do it by sniffing, right, their oral sense, and a dolphin will do it by their echolocution. They'll scan you, and you can hear it and you can feel it in a way if you're lucky enough to be close enough. And that scanning, right? They'll bounce their sound out from their melons and they'll read you. And that's why they can recognize when a woman is pregnant, because they also recognize the condition, because they live with females that are pregnant. So they understand that. And it's very moving to see their behavior around pregnant women who are in the water. They'll circle up and they'll just show a more intense focus. That interaction made me pretty evangelical about protecting the reef, because the dolphins rely on the reef. All the creatures rely on the reef. I was doing some shark conservation work, swimming with sharks to promote, way before Shark Week ever was a thing, because sharks were being killed off for their fins, for the shark cartilage, for an aphrodisiac, and a delicacy. And if you lose the lowest part of the food chain, meaning the micro beings that are in the reef, or the top of the food chain, which is the shark population, that's not by size, that's by predator, then you have upset a system that is reflective of our health as a planet. So the health of the ocean is a direct corollary to the health of the entire planet. And that's why if we damage the health of the ocean, it's because we're damaging every other aspect of the planet too. The environment is so interconnected. So I serve an organization called Heal the Bay that's local to our Southern California area, and we protect in various ways. We serve in various ways. We use science and data to advocate and educate. We have an aquarium that serves our public school systems. We bring in Title I schools, 10,000 students a year, many who have never seen the ocean. They get up close and personal to a shark, little baby shark tanks, and see our sea creatures to learn what it takes to protect them and actually see the ocean, some for the first time. We use advocacy to fight against illegal dumping. Our sewage plant back at 40 years ago when we were founded by a woman named Dorothy Green, whose kids were getting sick from going in the ocean. She was noticing so many other people were getting sick. It's because bacteria was growing in the ocean because the Hyperion treatment plant had no regulations on dumping. We are regulating what is going in the ocean now by studying it. We take samples and we can tell the public by our beach report card whether the water is safe today for the bacteria levels. We are studying all the debris from the fires, and we're measuring compounds that have never been measured before because they haven't existed in the ocean. And that's the fire retardants that have come off, all the plastics, the lithium batteries, the things that have now, you know, polluted our shorelines, and what that will mean for the future and the sea creatures that have ingested it, and whether or not people, they just shouldn't be eating fish that they're pulling out of the ocean now. That's a long answer, but I wanted you to be aware of what Heal the Bay is doing and what we've been doing for 40 years.
Well, no, thank you. It's important work. Thank you, Sharon Lawrence, for your openness and versatility, which gives us a model of how to be in the world, and for sharing your courage of creating complex, nuanced characters that shine a light on the human condition, the importance of journalism for maintaining a thriving democracy, and your advocacy, which is so inspiring. We all live on one planet we call home. Thank you for adding your voice to One Planet Podcast and the creative process.
Thank you, Mia. It's a joy to be with you.
The Creative Process Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interviews producers on this episode were Sophie Garnier and Alyssa Emond. The Creative Process is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Katie Foster. Wintertime was composed by Nicholas Anadolis and performed by the Athenian Trio. We hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community, exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just follow us on Instagram on @creativeprocesspodcast and send us a DM. Thanks for listening.